From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
I'm Philip Gurevich, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9, AM 820, and WNYC.org. Nearly 8 months have passed since the Indian Ocean tsunami, and countries affected by the disaster continue to face a long and arduous recovery. But for some of these societies, pre-existing civil conflicts have greatly complicated the process. Joining me now to talk about how Sri Lanka is faring is Dayan Jayatilaka, a Sri Lankan political scientist and newspaper columnist whom I first met in Colombo, Sri Lanka's capital, a few weeks after the tsunami. I'm pleased to welcome Dayan Jayatilaka to the Lopate Show's weekly underreported feature.
Hi, Philip.
How are you?
Well, that's always a complicated question, but I'm doing okay, thanks.
Good to hear it. And tell me, you grew up in Sri Lanka, but last year you were living in Australia for a while, and then you returned to Sri Lanka shortly before the tsunami. What brought you back at that time?
Well, I had dropped out of grad school 20 years ago when I was a Fulbright scholar. But last year, I thought I'd go back and do my PhD, so I went away to Brisbane, Australia. And then I had this feeling that war was going to break out again in December last year. And I'm a kind of a crisis junkie. I couldn't stay away from a good war, so I came back for the war, for Christmas and New Year, and caught the tsunami instead. That's what happened.
So you say that you thought the war would break out. What made you feel have this feeling that December was the day that it would start, or the date that it would start? What was going on at the backdrop there?
Yeah, Velupille Prabhakaran, the leader of the Tamil Tigers, had made his annual address, what he calls the Great Heroes Day address, which falls coincidentally on his birthday, or the morning after his birthday. And in that, he had very explicitly stated that the limits of his patience, quote-unquote, had been reached, and that he was about to make a major decision, that it was an existential moment, as it were. The speech was full of indications that he was going to cross the line, that he was going back to war. That wasn't the only piece of evidence. There were a number of other moves being made, the forced posture of the Tamil Tigers in the Northeast. A lot of signals that war was about to break out and that he would initiate it. Later, after the tsunami, information came out from respected independent Tamil columnists like D.B.S. Jayaraj, writing from Canada, which said that which even gave dates as to when this surprise attack would have been launched. One of the reports even indicated credibly that it was to be the morning of the day that the tsunami hit, but the whole plan went awry because of the tsunami. So it wasn't just a gut feeling on my part. There was that as well, but there was evidence in terms of his talk and in terms of what he was doing.
You know, in this country, of course, most people know of the Tamil Tigers, if at all, really as one of the supposed inventors of suicide bombing. Anyway, some of the most innovative suicide bombers, terrorist group, the people who whose movement was responsible for killing Rajiv Gandhi when he was Prime Minister of India. Tell me a little bit, when you say that Prabhakaran, their leader, was preparing to go back to war and that there were all these signs. Going back to war means what? There had been a ceasefire for how long, and how long before that had the war been going on?
Well, the war has been going on for roughly 20 years, give or take a few more. The Tamil Tigers were founded in 1976, so if that's the cutoff date, we're talking about a quarter century of conflict. The ceasefire had been in operation for 2 years. Now, it was a very funny kind of ceasefire, because the number of killings perpetrated by the Tigers during the ceasefire would have qualified in any other country as a low-intensity conflict. It was hardly a peaceful period. But given the kind of bloodletting we have experienced for a quarter century in Sri Lanka, it was some kind of peace. So Yes, for 2 years we had a simmering, low-intensity conflict of several dozen deaths rather than thousands. That was the situation. But Prabhakaran had got restive even within the ceasefire process. And while his partner in peace, former Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe of the centre-right United National Party, was still in office, the Tamil Tigers walked out of the negotiation process in April 2003 and never really came back. So they had disengaged. Prabhakaran had been headed for the exit ramp for quite some time, and he was poised to break out of the ceasefire around December, early January of last year, and early January this year, of course.
I'm Philip Gurevich here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dayan Jayatilekha, a political scientist and newspaper columnist from Sri Lanka. And we're going to talk shortly about what it is that the Tamil Tigers want in this war. But let's talk for a moment, Dayan, if you will, about you describe how there were reports, credible reports afterwards, that on the very morning that the tsunami struck, there might have been a return to war by the Tamil Tigers. And certainly right around that period, there was an escalation toward a resumption of full-scale hostility.
That's right.
Then the ocean surges, strikes the island, wipes out much of the east coast of the island, kills over 30,000 people, roughly half the number of people who had been killed in all this quarter century of conflict. And how was that? What was that like? There you were, waiting for a war, and suddenly there's a catastrophe. What did you think? What did you expect? And how quickly did your mind go to the political consequences?
Philip, it was as if something was about to happen. All the signs were there. The air was supercharged. And instead of the war, we had the tsunami. But one felt like birds feel something happening. For days, one felt that something was going to burst. Something was going to give. Nobody thought that it would be nature. But nature it was. You people started phoning. You turned on your TV sets, and there were reports, and even there were cameras in some places, which recorded the waves coming in, people drowning. There were sort of real time shots being fed into all our homes. Yes, on the one hand, it looked like a giant eraser had wiped out all the old equations. That the shift in the tectonic plates that took place off Sumatra had caused this huge change, and nothing would ever be the same again. But then at the back of one's mind, you wondered, because sometimes tectonic plates of consciousness, of politics, of society, don't really shift as do the geographic tectonic plates. And you wondered whether this would mean that things would change, or that the waves would recede and everything would be pretty much the same as before. There were clearly two possibilities: that this would make us all change the way we thought, the way we were, because we'd never experienced this. Generations had experienced nothing like this before. That was one possibility. And the other was that even this disaster would widen the rift between the Tigers and the state, between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. And we were at a crossroads. I remember I kind of ripped off James Baldwin, the famous "The Fire Next Time," which of course Baldwin took from what was known as a Negro spiritual. And I wrote a piece and called it "The Water This Time." And I was talking about these two possibilities. Well, for a while it looked like people were thrown together. Communities were thrown together. The Tigers and the state were thrown together, and we could break through to something new, a new place. But it didn't happen.
That was certainly when I arrived in Sri Lanka just after New Year's, so not more than 10 days after the tsunami. And the mood was very much one of sort of shock and hope, strangely. And I was surprised by that because, I mean, I guess the president had given this speech a few days after the tsunami saying, look, nature has led the way and showed us that we cannot be divided, because nature itself doesn't discriminate amongst peoples. It wiped out the two ethnic groups are the three in this country, the Sinhalese, who dominate the government, the Tamils, who are given rise to the Tigers, the Muslims. Everybody was affected equally. And in a sense, she basically tried to harness the imagery and the effect and the moment of the tsunami as an occasion for national unity, which is what you're describing your column as being. How long did it take before that started to lose its credibility?
Well, Philip, in the first place, it's true that the president said that, but she wasn't in Sri Lanka at the time of the tsunami. It is no fault of hers. But what I'm saying is that this wasn't a top-down, presidential-led or politician-led moment. This was a moment in which people right down there at what used to be called the grassroots, behaved very differently. Buddhist monks opened their temples to Tamil refugees. Tamils helped Sinhalese. Muslims helped both. Sri Lankan Navy guy died, drowned, having saved a Muslim child, but unable to save the other one. Sri Lankan army soldiers donated blood to a hospital in tiger-controlled area, knowing that the SOS had come in from the tigers, that they needed blood. I mean, that's the kind of thing that was happening. The cities fed the coast. People organized convoys of relief, which went through television stations, competed with each other to send relief out into all corners of the tsunami-affected areas. So it was rolling. It was rolling at the grassroots from civil society, from among the people. The presidential statement really reflected that. It didn't catch it on the wing, but mm-hmm. it reflected that a few days or a week or two into the process. Now, what happened was that moment lasted for weeks, maybe even for months. People were ready for a change of all communities, but the tigers held on until the moment had passed. This was very, very conscious, very considered. They were not going to seize the moment. They were going to allow the moment to dissipate, because the last thing they wanted was for the old enmity to vanish, for the old polarization to dissolve. And that is what had been happening immediately after the waves struck. That's what had been happening. So the tigers waited till the waves receded and the moment receded. And the Sri Lankan government itself was so tardy, so unimaginative in its political and diplomatic, in its political response, that that magic moment, that portal, the portal started closing. Now it's closed shut.
So really what was started as a moment of hope ended up becoming the tsunami, became, instead of the tsunami washing away the political enmity in some way has swallowed up that moment of promise that the tsunami seemed to represent amidst its catastrophe.
Well, just as the tsunami waves receded, so did the hope that the tsunami generated, leaving behind not only wreckage of homes and houses and schools, but also the contours of the old conflict. Those remain.
I'm Philip Gurevich. I'm here for Leonard Lopate. And I'm speaking with Dayan Jayatilekha, a Sri Lankan political scientist and newspaper columnist, about that country's civil war, and the effect of the tsunami on that conflict. I'm Philip Gurevich, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820 and WNYC.org. And I'm talking to Dayan Jayatilekha, a Sri Lankan political scientist and newspaper columnist. And Dayan, we've been talking a bit now about the way that the tsunami and the civil war in Sri Lanka intersected and affected one another. Let's go back a little bit and understand this civil war. I mean, this is a country that's totally divided at this point in a physical sense. There is partway up the country, about two-thirds of the way up the country from south to north. The island is bisected by a border and a frontier, and beyond that, there's a territory that's controlled by a rebel movement, the Tamil Tigers. What do they want? Where did they come from, and did it have to be this way?
Philip, the Tamil Tigers are known as a movement that is fighting for an independent or separate, if you will, a Tamil country, a Tamil state. It's not a movement that's fighting for federalism or regional autonomy. This is not like the Southern Sudan, the SPLM. This is a movement that wants to carve out an independent sovereign country in the northeastern area of the island. But I think that's not the most important thing about the Tigers. What's most important is that the Tamil Tigers are the only movement anywhere in the world that has killed political leaders of more than one country. I mean, they killed a Sri Lankan president, tried to kill another one, killed a whole number of Sri Lankan democratic politicians, but they also killed the grandson of Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister. They killed Rajiv Gandhi. I mean, this is the only movement that has resorted to that level of terrorism. Nobody else. Not Al-Qaeda, Black September. Nobody has done that. And these guys, as Robert Pape points out in his new book, these guys are the prime wholesalers of suicide bombings. Not a single Islamic fanatical movement, reprehensible as their actions are, not one of them has come even close to the number of suicide bombings that the Tigers have perpetrated. So it's not just that they are a secessionist or separatist movement. That I think is now even secondary. What is fundamental is that they are a terrorist movement, and they are also fanatical to an extreme degree. Velupile Prabhakaran, the leader of the Tigers, is named in their movement's literature as the sun god. It reminds me of the Japanese emperor during World War II. And there's a definite link with the whole kamikaze phenomenon. He's called the sun god, and there are times that he's also referred to in Tiger or pro-Tiger literature as the leader of the world, the ruler of the world. I mean, this is Hitlerian. The Tigers, the Tiger sympathizers, the Tiger front organizations have festivals in which young men roll bare-bodied on the hot, tarred roads of Tamil cities behind a chariot carrying the portrait of Velupile Prabhakaran. So we are talking not of merely of an independence movement or guerrilla movement. We are talking about something very, very distinctive. Suicide bombings, cult of personality, almost a deification, assassinations, and the international ramifications of this. I mean, in 2002, December, this was the BBC's Asia Today, I think December 11th, 2002. The leader of the Tigers' naval arm, the Sea Tigers, this guy Suse, he spoke to the BBC's Frances Harrison and told her that he thinks that Al-Qaeda learned from Sea Tiger suicide tactics when they attacked the USS Cole in Aden Harbor, and he was very proud of it. He said, we think that other movements should learn from our tactics. We think that Al-Qaeda learned from our tactics when they hit the USS Cole in Aden. I mean, the Tigers have really not been understood in the United States for what they are, a very powerful example and a very bad example with a global reach.
And yet this wildly illegitimate movement, as you describe it, an extremist in every way, comes out of some sort of legitimate grievances on behalf of the Tamil people. I mean, as you describe it, the Tamil Tigers have, in a sense, hijacked the Tamil cause and claim to speak for the Tamil people, which probably lots of Tamils, certainly that I encountered in Sri Lanka, made clear that they did not. Why is it that this country, this small island, which was not affected seriously by ethnic conflict before before independence from colonialism in the late 40s, Why did it become divided as an independent country in the last half century? What is it that makes the Sinhalese Buddhist majority and the Tamil minority at odds in this way, and has created a conflict that makes it very hard to see how to put that island back together?
Yeah, Philip, that's a good question, because we need to grasp both dimensions. There are many Sinhalese who would point out to the terrorist and fanatical character of the Tamil Tigers, but would choose to ignore the roots of the conflict. And on the other hand, there are quite a few Tamils and a few Sinhalese who would point out to the roots of the conflict, the causation, and use that to condone the kind of fascist fanaticism of the Tigers. I think it's important to avoid both those extremes. Now, after World War II, the countries of South Asia had to make an important decision when they became independent. What kind of places did they want to be? Pakistan went one route, the whole notion of Islam as the founding basis of a separate country, a religious or confessional state. India, I think, was most successful, which is, it was an idea of a multilingual, multi-ethnic, a quasi-federal state, unity in diversity, fairly similar, if you like, to the experience of the United States and the decisions, the path chosen by the founding fathers. Now, Sri Lanka, we went halfway. It was halfway between India and Pakistan. Sri Lanka was far more advanced than either, more advanced even than India, in that we started off with a functioning multi-party democracy. It took till 1977 for India to experience a change of government, though it did have free and fair elections. They just didn't have that kind of party system. Sri Lanka did. So it was ahead of the game in South Asia in that respect, in the respect of democracy, of participation, of multi-party, of competitive democracy. But on the other hand, in terms of identity, of who we are, we never really resolved that. We didn't go the Indian route. So there was no notion of a Ceylon or Sri Lanka that was really multi-ethnic, where Sinhalese, Tamils, Muslims, Eurasians, Christians, Hindus could all be equal and all part of that. There was a tug of war between the majority of the Sinhalese, that is the Sinhala Buddhists, who felt that this was the only country in which a particular pristine or pure form of Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, was preponderant. And that identity, that exclusive or preponderant identity, had to be entrenched. It was almost a Zionist thing. And that was compounded by a notion that the Sinhala language, this was the only place in the world where the Sinhala language was spoken. So these restrictive identities lay upon each other, layer upon layer. So you had an island with an island mentality. And the Tamils reacted. The Tamils' point being, hey, you know, Tamil is a language that's spoken throughout the world. There are 50 million co-ethnics in neighboring Tamil Nadu. So you had a majority, a Sinhala Buddhist majority, with a minority complex, because they thought, look, I mean, we are dwarfed in the region, so we've got to maintain our differentials. We've got to have this kind of fortress. And you had the Tamils, a minority with a majority complex, thinking, okay, we are a minority on this island, but hey, I mean, we've got 50 million brethren across the water. And it is this kind of schizophrenic, or there was this rock opera called, Quadrophenia, a long time back, maybe about 20, 25 years, The Who had this rock opera. It's double schizophrenia. I think that's what we had. We had a huge personality disorder from the moment that we were born as a country.
I'm Philip Gurevich here for Leonard Lokpate. I'm speaking with Dayan Jayatilaka, Sri Lankan political scientist, newspaper columnist, and rock historian. And this is New York Public Radio, WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. Obviously, this, when you have a tension like this with a majority that starts to make its language the only official language, that starts to exclude and limit the space for the Tamil minority in public life, this gave rise to serial waves of violence, each worse than the last, between the 50s and the 60s. And then in 1983, there was the worst possible outbreak, or the worst outbreak so far, certainly, that was precipitated by an act of the then burgeoning Tiger movement, and led to really a massive pogrom across the country by Sinhalese reacting against Tamil militancy. At that time, that was when you dropped out of graduate school and returned to the country, and you yourself, for a time, saw armed struggle as a real possibility in the country. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Philip, at that time, I this was way back, I was a sort of whiz kid. I'd got a first class in political science, the best results in 40 years from my university. I'd got a Fulbright scholarship, and I'd come over to the United States and opted not to go to any of the Ivy League colleges, and I wanted to work with, there were some Marxist hotshots in Binghamton, in upstate New York. And I was working with Emmanuel Wallerstein, James Petras, and all these guys here. And then I went back to Sri Lanka, ostensibly for my research, but it was just a holiday. Came back in early 83 for a Pugwash conference at the University of Michigan. And then I went back, and within days, there was this firestorm. Yes, the Tigers, quote-unquote, started it in the sense that they ambushed an army patrol, but that in no way justified the pogrom that was unleashed, in which thousands of innocent Tamils were killed by Sinhalese mobs. And worse still, there were two massacres within the Valikada jail, that is a prison in Colombo. I saw all of this. I literally was on the streets, and saw this kind of violence, the killing, guys leaned against walls and killed. And there were also friends of mine in Valikada, including a Tamil doctor, Dr. Rajasundaram, who was beaten to death by a mob. There were Tamil political prisoners whose eyes were plucked out. And all of that took place with impunity. Not that the government encouraged it, but it didn't trust its own armed forces, which by that time had become monoethnic and monolingual and monoreligious, to actually be able to crack down. So it was a crisis of civilization, as the president at the time, J.R. Jayawardena, called it. It was a crisis of civilization, and it was also a crisis of conscience for all of us. And I felt a strong moral imperative, if you like, to just drop everything, because I'd been learning, I'd been talking the talk, but it was time to walk it. And I dropped out of graduate school and my doctoral studies, and became a revolutionary activist, if you want to call it that. That's not what the state called it. I was indicted.
What did the state call it?
Yeah, well, I was indicted under the Prevention of Terrorism Act and the Emergency I was one of those 23 indicted. I was the first accused in that case. And they had 13 counts on which I was indicted, starting with conspiracy to overthrow the state through violence. So I suppose you could say they called it terrorism, yeah.
But, I mean, you were an urban guerrilla, let's say, and you were involved with not just Sinhalese, but also Tamils. I mean, as I understand it, what you were trying to do was see if there was, in between the two militant nationalist extremes, there could be a kind of militant national unity group. Is that the idea?
Well, Philip, we call it internationalism, and frankly, our sort of symbol, emblem, role model was Che Guevara, who transcended notions of borders and nationality. And it was, in that sense, noble but utopian. But what we were really trying to do, yes, was to build a bridge between left-wing Tamils, who were distinct from and even opposed to the Tigers, and left-wing Sinhalese, who were distinct from the JVP, the Janata Vimukti Peramuna, which was a Pol Pot-type singular Marxist but xenophobic movement. We were hoping against hope that Sinhalese and Tamils, young, radical, mostly educated, would be able to close the gap. It was a last desperate attempt, like this famous painting in the Sistine Chapel, trying to reach out the hands, trying to touch. We touched, all right, but we couldn't turn it around. We were caught. The caught, I don't mean literally, that happened too, but we were caught in the crunch, not so much, it wasn't so much the state. We were willing to take on the state and die in the attempt. But we were blindsided because the Tamil left, the secular guys who were not willing to kill Sinhalese civilians, they were battered by the Tamil Tigers, who accused them of being soft on the Sinhalese. The Tamil Tigers were going around killing Sinhalese civilians. And as for the rest of us, the Sinhalese, who are non-racist, who wanted to reach out to the Tamils, who wanted to recognize their right of self-determination, concede some sort of federalism or regional autonomy, we were people's throats were cut by the JVP, which was this Pol Potist red fascist movement. So we got caught in the crunch, Sinhalese and Tamils. And our group was multi-ethnic. Yeah, we had Sinhalese, we had Tamils, we had Muslims, we had people of different religions, different social classes. It was a pathetic, it was noble, but it was a microcosm of a Sri Lanka that we thought could be. But it was a microcosm that could not hold. It was crushed.
And you yourself were obliged to go underground or fled underground for a period of time?
Yeah, I was underground because I was indicted, and either I was going to be caught and maybe disappeared, or I would have been locked up. And I was on the run, and I remember those days and nights in for 3 years in different places, lonely rooms, empty rooms, different names. I forgot the name changes, but the soundtrack always kept running in my head. I used to, does the Allman Brothers track, what is it, Midnight Rider, is it, which says, "I ain't gonna let him catch me, no, I ain't gonna let him catch me." I mean, this used to keep on running through my head, saying, "I ain't gonna let him catch me." And they didn't catch me. The JVP didn't catch me, but they tried.
And in fact, when you came out from underground, you became a minister, isn't that right?
Yep.
I mean, that's some of the, I think for those of us who don't live in such a society, it's sometimes hard to grasp the speed with which such turnarounds can take place. And now the JVP, this Pol Potist movement that you're describing, is a partner of the president in a coalition government. Where do you see the future of Sri Lanka going? It's a place you've fought for, you've fought in, you feel at times defeated by.
And they also fought against the dominant culture, the consciousness and the narrow-mindedness, the racism. So yes, fought in, fought for, fought against, yeah.
And where do you see all these fights going these days? What's your prognosis? Is the war that you went back for last year just still hanging over the island?
Oh yes, the war is hanging over the island. It's one of those places where war may or may not be imminent, but it's immanent. I mean, it's latent. It can never be ruled out. It is always a possibility. It sometimes becomes a probability. It's one of those places in the world. Kashmir used to be that, but it's really no longer that. This is much more like the Middle East, if you want to put it that way. Yes, it's there, but I don't want to sound apocalyptic, because thanks to a terrible episode, that is the London bombings, the terrorist outrages, the issue of terrorism has come right back into the forefront of global public opinion. And I think that the Tigers aren't really sure, though there's no direct correlation. I mean, nobody's going after the Tigers because of the London bombings. But the Tigers aren't really sure what the response would be of the world community. Okay, they probably planned for a deep strike into single areas, a first strike in which they can achieve most of their targets. They probably think that the international community would then enforce a ceasefire, which left them in charge of a larger area of terrain than they do now, and forced all the Sri Lankan counteroffensive. But that's very dicey, because I don't see any Sri Lankan government, particularly a government under electoral pressure, just succumbing to that. They'll roll with the punch and they'll fight back. They've always done that. And internationally, well, there's India. One doesn't know what India would do in the face of a Tiger first strike. And even the rest of the world, I mean, you know, United States, Britain, they're not going to come riding in, but they could help the Sri Lankans technologically in one way or the other. So I think the Tigers are doing this calculus. They would like to, they're probably tempted to resort to a blitzkrieg, but they may not be able to do that. Or they may not be able to hold what they take in case they go for it.
So it's an underreported story that we'd best keep our eye on. I'm Philip Gurevich. I'm here today for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with Dayan Jayatilekha, Sri Lankan political scientist and newspaper columnist. Dayan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Philip. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.